Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, April 19th, 2017, and open another hearing on Senate Bill 5524, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission Budget Bill. And welcome back after a long absence, Executive Director Ben Cannon.
Long absence? Seems like it was just yesterday.
Madam Chair, just briefly as an opening, it is our hope that we can finish up HEC today. And there's also a fee bill on the agenda. For those that are looking for the presentation, we've had to split it in two parts because we're up to 600 slides. So there, back on the 27th, there's HEC presentation part two. And then you go to page 535 on the presentation on the little numbers at the bottom, but if you're looking at the computer's pagination, it's page 235.
Just to put a little pressure on him, would you read the bottom line?
Yes,
of our
thank you. Great minds think alike, Senator Thompson. I was planning to lead with your presentation with this little note on the bottom that says there will be no meeting on Thursday if HEC completes its presentation today. No pressure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
That would be really welcome. That would be really disappointing. What would I do with that time?
All that found time, I can't imagine.
Oh, sorry.
Madam Co-Chair.
Go right ahead, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. You can turn to your final slide in the packet. joined by Dave Zerbe, our Director of Operations, who will assist me in the presentation of our what we hope will be our final day of presentation to this committee. You have nearly survived the endurance test of higher education budget presentation, and we really do appreciate the attention that you have shown to the budget we've brought forward. So, let me dive right in. We're on what we've labeled as day 15, and the focus today will be on our agency's operational budget. So for the most part, you've heard to this point about the state investments in universities and college and student aid and access programs, in other higher education and workforce-related activities that we help to support. Today, the focus will be on our actual state agency, its positions, its FTE, its operations that helps to support all of that additional investment. In setting up and preparing the presentation that you've heard over the last few weeks, we've tried to sort of follow the rule of thumb of spending our time in proportion to the dollars that are in our budget. And as a result, we've not spent a lot of time on the very small percentage of state dollars that are invested in our agency operations, our agency staff, which is obviously a much smaller state investment than the very significant funding streams that you provide to the institutions and to the students and to our workforce investments. But here we are with a small but obviously very important investment in the state agency operations. I hope as we launch this this morning, I hope that over the last few weeks and in today's wrap-up, you have come to see the HEC and the role of the agency and of the commission as reflecting more than just a collection of programs and investments in higher education, that in fact what we're attempting to do as an agency and as a commission is to provide a coordinated and integrated approach to how we do higher education in Oregon, both the policy recommendations that we make, the investment recommendations that we make, the coordination that we provide and support that we provide to higher education in a integrated and coordinated fashion, which is a new thing for Oregon. We've not had until very recently a single point of focus, a single state agency, a single board and commission that's responsible for the entirety of Oregon higher education and workforce investments. So we're still new, but we're attempting to bring that level of integration and coordination to our
Mr. Co-Chair.
So is this going to bring total transferability for our students?
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, appreciate the question and the concern for student transferability between our at least our public institutions, potentially the private ones that we also have concern and responsibility for. We are working on that, and you will hear likely hear a bill that moved out of a policy committee in the House yesterday that I presume will be coming to this subcommittee that deals from a policy standpoint with that very question of transferability of student credits from 2-year to 4-year public institutions. And that work and that emphasis is central to the HECS work, and I'll mention in a few slides the offices that are involved in the transferability issue. To be clear, we don't have the sole and exclusive authority as an organization under law to describe for or to require institutions to accept transfer credit. We don't make those decisions, but we do help to coordinate and convene and lead in policy work that can address that issue.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, if you need additional authority, I think there's vast, vast support in both houses and both parties for moving in the direction of total transferability for all of our students. Not only does it benefit our students and the state, but it'll save money overall.
Senator Munro, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, we, again, the commission and its strategic plan emphasizes the importance of transferability of credits, clear student pathways from K-12 to community college to 4-year institution and among and between those institutions. So we certainly share the intent that you have reflected.
Good. Gene and I are working on it.
Madam Co.
Representative Wisman.
Matt, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and Senator Munro, Co-Chair. Yeah, I was on the committee. We passed this out yesterday, and we had a lot of support from the HEC, and Representative Mark Johnson led the effort, and it relates to the governor's 21-13 or something about transferability. We're referencing in that bill, and so I think with the HEC support, we're going to have some meetings to see how we can share FTEs. The bill we passed yesterday phases in. We try to get so many credits and work the way up. So I think it'll be you'll be glad to see it, and it's a big step forward. The policy committee, I've talked to you also, we're going to have continue the OER program. The Open Education Research Program is going to need some staff. So I think we have some suggestions and ideas that we'll talk the co-chairs about and bring in, and the HEC, see if we get their support in doing this.
Yeah, good.
Great. Go ahead.
Thanks. So the next two slides are budget slides. Essentially what we're including on these slides is the dollars in the state budget that support our agency positions and operations. So separating out practically everything else you've heard about state investments that we administer in workforce and public universities and community colleges and scholarship programs, and now focused on the dollars that support the operations and activity of our agency and staff to administer those investments, to do the coordination work, to provide the regulatory oversight where we have that responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. So this slide is really focused on what we're calling here loosely our agency operations. As you can see, it involves a variety of fund types, general fund, other fund, and federal funds. We've included all three of those on this slide, where typically these slides only designate the general fund. Total funds there is the sum of the three rows that precede it. If you take just the general funds for a moment, so the top row here, you'll see that our CSL budget reflects a decrease from the 2015-17 LAB as a result of one-time investments that are not, or one-time positions that are not, limited duration positions that are not continued. There is an increase in the GRB that reflects some policy option packages that we'll talk about in just a moment. The roughly $20 million in general funds for our agency operations represents about 1% of the total general fund dollars that we administer that are in our budget. So if you think of the agency staff as administering this roughly $2 billion investment, we do so with roughly $20 million of staffing that supports the folks who are in this room and many of the folks who are in this room and who do the work that we've described over the previous few weeks. There are, in addition to the slide that you just saw, we do have in this category several sort of special payments that we haven't talked about or spent much time on in previous weeks that I just want to note here. the majority of those special payments to institutions, programs, and partners that are in our 2015-17 budget are not in our 2017-19 CSL or GRB budget. Again, they were one-time investments. For example, a roughly $6 million investment in Umpqua Community College to support recovery efforts there. Some Oregon Promise student success investments, again, that were in the 15-17 LAB that are reduced or eliminated in our 17-19 CSL and GRB. Some additional e-board investments. So we just want to note that there are sort of $14.5 million of one-time dollar or of special payments that we haven't really described yet in our 15-17 budget, the majority of which are phased out as we move into 17-19. Just a reminder about the HEC role within the larger higher education enterprise. We are I really look at our role not as oversight, but as a partnering organization, both with the state entities on the left-hand side of this slide, as well as the public and more locally governed entities on the right-hand side of this slide. We don't sit in a position of oversight or authority for the most part. We are a sister agency, if you will, that works alongside our community college and university boards, OHSU, and the privates to help coordinate Oregon's higher education system. We are led, I report to, a commission of 14 appointed members, 9 of whom are voting. You see their names here. This commission, just briefly, this is not for the faint of heart. I've worked with a number of state boards and commissions. This one has a rigorous meeting schedule. We meet, it meets almost one time a month for a full day, plus subcommittee meetings that add another day. So these are volunteers who give extensively of their time. They come from around the state, east and west, valley and non-valley. They represent a variety of different perspectives, and they take on real issues. This is a commission with significant authority. So, for example, the decision to overhaul the way the state allocates dollars to public universities, introducing student success and completion models, that was led and ultimately voted on and adopted by our commission. Decisions about new programs. So when, for example, the University of Oregon proposed a new program in Portland, a new graduate program that PSU said, this feels like it's in our turf, that came through our commission, as do other programs for new program approvals, and our commission had to deliberate on that. The capital recommendations that it provides to you, the budget recommendations that it makes, this is a hardworking and instrumental commission that has a heavy lift. Turning to our agency and how we're organized at present, we have 8 offices, some of them quite small, some of them significantly larger. Our total FTE, which you'll see in a moment, is about 120, but they're divided into these 8 offices. This is a sort of unique way to describe the organizational chart we've put around the outside, in that sort of outside ring, the office that I lead, the executive director of policy, communications, and HR. We've gotten there as well. Our operations and our research and data office, they're really providing support to the 5 in the middle, OSAC, which is, of course, focused on student scholarship and access, university, public university, private post-secondary, community colleges, and workforce development and workforce investments. And we'll talk more in the upcoming slides about each of those 8 offices. I mentioned a couple of POPs that in the governor's budget request additional funding for our operations, even as we lose some significant positions and funding streams in our CSL budget. That's described in the middle portion of the slide, where POP 109 includes 2 new positions, one that has been recommended to us consistently by those who have looked at our agency. We really do need an internal auditor position, especially given the nearly $2 billion in state general funds that we're responsible for. We also are requesting in that POP an additional HR A3 positions of this to support our significant human resource needs. We also, in our governor's budget, reclassify a few positions that were requested for reclassification through the collective bargaining process, Article 81 requests. So that is reflected in our governor's budget. The governor's budget, though, also takes some reductions to our CSL budget. They're described here, the special payments I alluded to in an earlier slide, but the personal services and SNS reductions of 3% and 6% respectively. These will be challenging for our organization to manage, but they're in the GRB. We're working on figuring out how we would, in fact, reduce our personal services by nearly 400,000 and our SNS by over 300,000. And then you see a little more detail on the reduction to the special payments that are in our budget. Again, these were efforts the governor made to try to sort of trim our budget as she did with others, and we're working through what that would mean for our ability to operate. The other significant new investment that's in the governor's budget, however, is in POP 105. It could probably be considered a placeholder because the dollar amount, the $2.5 million general fund that's requested here, is an estimate of the costs of replacing a legacy data system that we keep at our Office of Student Access and Completion. This is the, we call it FAMIS. It's a financial aid management system. Every FAFSA that an Oregon student completes and submits to the feds, we get a copy of, and we use it as the basis for awarding Oregon Opportunity Grants, the Oregon Promise, private scholarships that we administer, and we have, not surprisingly, a massive data system to manage the hundreds of thousands of student records that contain personally identifiable and sensitive information related to the scholarship applicants in Oregon, really college students who complete FAFSAs in Oregon. That is a legacy system. I guess that's a fancy way of saying it's an old data system that is in need of upgrades. We've been working through the stage gate process with DAS for some time. We're in the middle of getting the business case that will identify more precisely what our options are and the costs associated them for improving, upgrading the financial aid management system. And there are security needs here, just to be, you know, clear and blunt. This is in significant part of, about being able to ensure the ongoing security and integrity of the data that we handle, the personally identifiable data that we handle. So that, when you saw the increase in the GRB, the increase in our agency operations budget over CSL, this is responsible for the majority of that increase. Turning to our offices a little bit more specifically, here the eight are again the eight that were on that prior chart, and then the number of positions and the funding blends for each. Our total operations budget in the GRB, quite similar to the CSL, is 120.5 FTE, 128 positions, and you see the reduction here from the 15-17 LAB, where we were at 143 positions and 124 FTE. We're going to go through just one slide for each of the offices, just so you get a better sense of what they do, as well as their funding sources. The office directors are in the room today, and Dave or I or the directors can help answer questions that you may have about any of the work that occurs in these offices. Most of it's been described or touched on in the prior weeks of presentation. This is the executive director.
Yeah. Can I ask you, can you go back to one slide? So can you just talk about, so the reduction in staffing. So 15 positions that are only not quite 4 FTE. Where were they?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Senator Monroe, the majority of those, if not all of them, were limited duration positions, and they're in a variety of places within the organization and offices within the organization. I don't know, Dave, if you want to add to that.
For the record, Dave Zerbe, Director of Operations, Madam Co-Chair. Most of them were for the one-time special projects that we had. They were staffing for those. So the we had out of the Oregon Promise, we had the transitional support. We had additional pieces of staffing. Typically, we received during last session, I believe we received a lot of policy bills that had pieces of positions. So we would get three or four positions with a 0.1 or a 0.2 FTE, primarily from fiscal impacts from the policy bills. And so they had things around the Oregon Promise. We had things around the FAMIS system, as we've actually been working on the FAMIS system development for a while. And we had a couple pieces of FTE for that go away. So just a variety of all of those policy things that were one time that we were bringing up that we had pieces attached to.
But it's not, I mean, it's not 15 humans.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. And is any of that 3.8 FTE, is any of that from your vacancies, in your vacancy savings? Thank you.
So this slide describes our executive director of policy and communications office. We have in our budget 10 FTE and 10 positions. It's primarily a general funded budget. Each of the next slides has a pie chart that shows the funding streams, GF, other fund, and federal fund that support the office. You see here the kind of primary functions of this office. This is where Kyle Thomas, our legislative director, and I Hartigan, Cheryl Myers, who are culture and equity directors and communications directors, myself, our human resources staff, and the staff that supports the commission are housed. I want to note here and the role that our deputy director, Bob Brew, who's sitting behind us today, plays in helping lead the organization, working closely with me, and he also works within this office. Moving on, our Community College and Workforce Development Office. You've heard quite a bit about the ways in which the HEC helps coordinate and support community colleges, and the real variety of ways in which we do so. That's reflected and depicted in the variety of funding streams here, including significant support from federal funds and other funds, as well as GRB. This office is led by Patrick Crane, our community college director. Our university coordination office, this is one way of thinking about this. These are positions and funding that was and responsibility that was inherited from the chancellor's office of the Oregon University System when it was taken apart. To be clear, we don't have all of the same responsibilities or authorities as that office did to govern and oversee the public universities, but we did inherit some of their funding and budget and legislative and coordination responsibilities, and we do that work through our Office of University Coordination, also here in Salem, and co-led by Veronica Dujon, our Director for Academic Planning and Policy, and Andrew Rogers, our Director for Budget and Finance. This is a general funded budget or general funded office of 8 positions doing all of our work with public universities. Our Office of Private Postsecondary, which you heard about a couple of weeks ago, which is responsible for really regulation and oversight of the private postsecondary system in Oregon, as well as being the approving agency for veterans benefits in the state of Oregon. This is entirely funded through fees and through a federal contract on the VA side. So you see no general fund in this office. It has 12 positions, almost 10 FTE. It's led by Juan Baez Arevalo and is also based here in Salem. Our Office of Student Access and Completion, which operates our scholarship programs as well as outreach and student access programs, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Promise, private scholarships that we administer, Aspire, other financial aid and access programs. It is used to be its own agency, like CCWD, before it was incorporated within the HEC. It is now one of our 8 offices. It is funded through a combination of general funds as well as other funds. Those other funds principally reflect the fees that the private organizations that want us to administer their scholarships pay to the office. It's based in Eugene. Juan Baez Arevalo is its interim director. Its staff is about 20 FTE, just sort of 20 FTE in the budget, 23 positions. It is our one sort of Eugene-based office and has a long-standing presence there Don't see that changing. We spend a fair amount of time on the road between Salem and Eugene. Our Office of Workforce Investments, which historically has been part of CCWD, but we now treat as a separate office led by Karen Hummelbaugh. It's is sort of a co-mingled office with some Department of Employment staff. That Department of Employment funding isn't and staff is not reflected on this sheet, which or this slide, which just expresses its HEC staff, but it works in conjunction with Department of Employment staff through a agreement with that agency. This administers the HEC workforce programs and the federal WIOA, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act investments. Not surprisingly, it is a primarily federally funded office of 21 positions, about 20 FTE. You see there is some general fund there, and there's general fund in our budget request, continuing general fund in our budget request to support the state investment in workforce support. Our office of turning to the final two offices, which along with the ED office help to support really all of the other functions. Our Office of Research and Data here in Salem, led by Amy Cox. This is where we primarily house student data from all of our sectors, public universities, community colleges, increasingly our privates, where student level data is reported to the HEC. We maintain significant and complicated data systems that we use to produce the kind of reports that you've seen over the last few weeks. We evaluate trends, we respond to legislative and public and media requests, and we report on federal programs and other programs that have reporting requirements through our Office of Research and Data. It is primarily a general funded office with 9 FTE, 9 positions.
And Ben, how do you find your data systems in that office? Because that and OSAC seem to be the biggest. And when you mention that the OSAC system is a legacy system, what's the status of this system or systems?
Representative Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, it is systems. We have managed multiple data systems through this office, and they're in different states. There a lot of work has gone on in the last couple of years, in part supported by state investment, to update and migrate those systems. Our primary concerns in terms of security and viability do relate to the FAMIS system that we mentioned to you earlier. That's why the funding request is there. We'd be happy to come back in phase two or as you see fit for a deeper discussion of the data needs and the sort of status of the HEC. We, as I think is clear and reflected in your question, we're responsible for a lot of data. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of student records a year with personally identifiable information, both coming through the financial aid system as well as coming from the colleges and universities. So this is an ongoing challenge. In our last office slide, we'll turn to operations where our IT staff is housed, and they have significant responsibility for helping manage that. We also are doing so increasingly through the state data center and our work with the Chief Information Office, but like I say, there's a lot to explore in response to your question, and we'd be happy to come back and do
perhaps
that.
A pop to anticipate in 2019.
Perhaps.
Okay, and also just to give you a heads up, I will also be interested in knowing how the longitudinal data system that we've been long working on at the K-12 level will be able to seamlessly merge with some of those HEC data systems as well.
And Co-Chair Smith-Warner, on that point, I can say quickly, this Office of Research and Data is working very closely with the Chief Education Office and the State Longitudinal Data System. Really, phase one of that project, the SLDF project, includes combining K-12 data and our higher education data. So we are a feeder agency to the SLDS, and we've been working, partnering very closely with the Chief Education Office over the last couple of years to prepare for the launch later this year of that project.
Thank you.
Our final office that Dave leads is reflected here, and this really is the office that supports all the rest, as well as administers the funding that we've described over the last few weeks. So quite a bit of accountants here, IT, procurement, budget. This is our kind of core operational staff. You see the variety of funding streams that help to support the work in the office. And without our operations office, without this staff, we would not work. We would not be able to process the payments, ensure that the colleges and universities receive their funds, ensure that we have a budget prepared, and make those data systems work, so on and so forth. So this operations office is really key to the whole organization. This is a picture from over a year ago now of a good chunk of our staff at a meeting in Eugene. We a few times a year gather as an entire organization. We are in different offices, two in Salem and one in Eugene, so it's relatively rare when we're able to all get together, but we've got a great staff and come increasingly to know each other as we learn to live together under the single HEC umbrella.
And one quick question about the staff. So are there any staff who go between the eight, who have crossover between the eight divisions? I would guess that geography would make most of that. And you don't have to know specific. But it always makes me wonder when I see there's a difference between FTE and actual number of positions. So it makes me wonder if there's folks who are half OSAC, half workforce, or operations.
Yeah, co-chairs with Porter. I don't think so. You probably noticed that Juan Baez Arevalo is serving in running two offices, one in Salem, one in Eugene, just during an interim period. So he certainly is doing that back and forth. Six of our eight offices are co-located in the public service building across the street here. Our workforce investment office is just a few blocks away in the employment department building, and our OSAC is in Eugene. So that's sort of our geographic spread, meaning it's not inconceivable that an employee could be divided between at least our Salem offices, and in Juan's case, Salem and Eugene. Just a reminder of our mission and values. We've alluded to a strategic plan that our commission has adopted and is in the process of, it adopted last summer. It's in the process of updating for 2017. We expect that to occur in August. We showed you this slide at the outset, and this is not at all a complete list of activities that we've, or successes that we've had since 2015, but wanted to, as we get to the conclusion here, provide you with some of those concrete examples of ways that a state coordinating commission with broad responsibility for higher education and workforce can help to make a difference, helping coordinate, helping respond to immediate needs, helping promote student success, helping respond to legislative requests. So the 23 reports that we've produced since 2015 for the legislature are a reflection of that. We have stepped up. We talked about most of the things on this slide already, but I'll just note the work that we did with support from the legislature in response to the ITT closure. We've responded to emergent situations that have occurred over the last couple of years, ones that we didn't expect or predict. Our response in helping coordinate others, really, in the aftermath of the UCC tragedy was another way in which our organization helped bring higher education collectively to the table to support students, faculty, staff, a community that was wounded. And we think that the breadth of connections that we have, the convening and coordinating role that we play, can and does add value to higher education in Oregon.
Thank you. Rep. Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Cannon, before the HEC, early in my legislative career, there was sort of a relationship between opportunity grant funding and tuition. Is that still, discussed? And does the Oregon Promise weigh into that? You know, I remember, like I said, I was on education. I first came in and would say to the students, do you want more opportunity grants or do you want lower tuition? So is that still a discussion, and how does Oregon Promise come into that?
Representative Wisnett, co-chair Smith-Warner, and co-chair Monroe, there are a couple of different ways of thinking about that. So one is, in terms of your decisions about where to invest state dollars, just as the commission in developing its recommendations to you has had to weigh those things, right? So you could take, theoretically, you could take all of the scholarship dollars, the opportunity dollars, invest them in our institutions and have a positive effect on tuition, right? Lower tuition. But there would be no state need-based aid, right? And alternatively, you could significantly reduce your funding for institutions, the colleges and universities, put that money in the opportunity grant, and tuition would rise, but you'd be giving a lot more state aid. Our commission has emphasized the importance of state aid, and our commission's number one recommendation consistently for state investment has been in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We've known that that means having fewer dollars to invest directly in the institutions, and as a result, having, you know, tuition increases to deal with. But the focus on the lowest income students on equity has led the commission to support the Oregon Opportunity Grant really at the top of the list. The governor's budget reflects that insofar as it, with very little new dollars on the table, puts new dollars in the Oregon Opportunity Grant and continuing funding for the Oregon Promise, even as institutional funding is well below what we know those institutions need in order to moderate tuition. So that's, I think, the heart of your question. These things do have, there is a relationship between them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Kennedy, I'm not sure, but I think the year 2005, I think that we asked the Student Association and they wanted less tuition, but that's, I'm not positive about that, but thank you for your comments.
We've shown throughout, we've mentioned key performance measures. I will do so again, but I'll also draw your attention to slides beginning that I won't go over, but they're provided for you beginning at number 567, which is the complete actual data associated with all of the key performance measures that are included within our budget. So you have to skip ahead a few, we're happy to respond to questions about that data, but we have presented in an appendix beginning on slide 567 all of our agency's key performance measures. Really, that concludes our presentation. The final slides here are just a reiteration of the budget priorities around affordability. In response really to the last question, Representative Wisnett, the emphasis on the promise and the opportunity grant is the number one priority in our budget. The continuing funding that we recommend for our institutions in order to support student success. The emphasis on creating student pathways, going back to Senator Monroe's question around transfer students and the need for continued investment in that work. Our 40-40-20 goal, to which all of this is linked, and our overarching budget priorities of the governor. I want to thank, as we finish, express particular gratitude towards your staff, Doug Wilson, who's just been really great to work with in helping plan this, and I sincerely mean that, in helping construct what's a very complicated budget to bring forward, involving a lot of partners, and Doug's been great in all of that planning and preparation, and then to the committee for its continued intention in this through this marathon. You've made it all 26.2 miles or 15 days of presentation, and we're grateful for your continuing interest, attention, and support. And with that, co-chairs, I'll conclude our presentation, and I think Patrick will have his section to give, but we stand at the ready to answer any questions.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I've mentioned this issue many times, the fact that the payment for community colleges is a flat per FTE, and I have encouraged us to look at whether or not the high-cost, high-benefit programs shouldn't receive a bit of a boost. Now, I've talked this over with some of my colleagues, and they always say, well, that would be a good thing to do when we have more money. But maybe this session might not be a good time to, because there would be winners and losers. But I am very concerned about the fact that many of our community colleges that have slots for more high-cost students in high-cost, high-benefit programs are not able to provide them. And so I would hope that during the next interim, your office could look at this, involve key legislators if you want to, interim committees, whatever, because I really do believe that it makes sense. We do it with K-12. You know, with K-12, higher-cost students get a boost in the formula. But we don't do that with community colleges, and I think we ought to look at that possibility. And hopefully in the following session, we won't be so short of money as we are now, and because this would be a lot easier to do if there's some extra money, so we're not robbing from anybody, we're just adding on.
Other questions? Okay, I'd like to ask Patrick Heath from DAS to go ahead and give his presentation. That we're a day ahead of your schedule, Patrick.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office. I have a brief presentation here today that's going to try to recap the presentation, HEC's presentation you have heard over the last 3 weeks. For those of you who don't know me, I'm relatively new to this assignment. I took over the HEC assignment from Bill McGee, who retired in December. So I have his cell phone number. If anyone on the committee has questions, they can reach out to him. In all seriousness, I'm hoping to be able to address whatever questions the committee has about the governor's budget. So as we talked about, HEC coordinates the state system of post-secondary education. As has been alluded to a number of times, governor's budget had to reduce funding to meet general fund constraints and made some investments in priority areas. One of the ways that we look at the budget at DAS is just in terms of broad categories of expenditures. This is the total fund budget for HEC, which is about $2.7 billion. And as you can see, roughly 82% of that is some form of payment to a third party, whether that be scholarships, whether that be support to institutions, whether that be support for individuals, that sort of thing. And then another 16% is debt service, which the state has been obligated in prior years. So when you look at the budget in this way, really, when we're looking at reductions, 98% of the budget is made up of pass-throughs that are either mandated by law or are, mandated by bond agreements or are essentially support to individuals or institutions. So looking more specifically, that was the total funds picture, but actually if you look at general fund, lottery fund, the picture is almost identical. 98.9% of general fund and lottery funds, which are the most flexible dollars, are made up of those two types of payments, meaning when we're looking at reductions, unfortunately that means reducing in areas of support or student aid. So looking at it from just by comparison to current service level, the biggest reductions that were made in the governor's budget were the Public University Support Fund, which was funded at $667 million, or a one way of looking at it would be it's flat funded from the legislatively adopted budget. The same with the Community College Support Fund, which was funded at $550 million. And then another area of reduction, which is all the way at the bottom, is the sports lottery was included in the all other because it by itself is not especially large. But that was reduced by $12.4 million in the governor's budget. Those are the sort of the biggest areas of decrease. In terms of investments that the governor's budget makes, there's really three. There's a full biennialization of the Oregon Promise Program that had been funded in 2016. At least that program, as in terms of the best estimates we had at the time, was funded in the governor's budget at $39.7 million. Oregon Opportunity Grant, there was an additional $5 million increase or investment. And then finally, the governor's budget invests $44 million in the outdoor schools program, which is shown under the extension service right here. So overall, the picture is not... shows the difficult choices that the governor had to make. There were reductions of $67.7 million in general fund lottery funds, with, again, the largest cuts to the support funds and sports lottery scholarships. There were other reductions made in general funds, lottery funds, administrative cuts of $0.7 million, which Director Cannon alluded to, and workforce cuts of $1 million.
Were those, Patrick, workforce cuts in general fund?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, yes.
Did that have any impact on the federal, any federal matching funds?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I am not 100% sure.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, no. There's no relationship between that general fund investment and the federal dollars.
Thank you.
I mentioned the three major investments the governor's budget makes. Two more major investments are at the bottom. One is Director Cannon alluded to, is $2.5 million as a placeholder for the financial accounting management information. I'm sorry, the financial aid management information system, and then $0.3 million for two positions needed for administrative capacity, the HR position and the internal auditor. This was not directly addressed in Director Cannon's testimony, but I just wanted to briefly walk through. There were a number of bonding investments made in the governor's budget. I realize that's not the purview of this committee, but just wanted to say there were a number of them, the largest being for the PSU graduate school, the capital improvements and sort of deferred maintenance for all universities, and then the residence hall at the Portland State, which is funded directly out of university tuition and fees. The community colleges also received funding for bonding investments included in the $90.2 million I have. There's roughly $15 million for campus security upgrades, which were made for both universities and community colleges. In addition to that, there were several large facilities that were being made, the Umpqua Industrial Technology Building at $8 million. And the PCC health training building renovation.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. David, Patrick, further down. Sorry. you mentioned security. Where do we stand now? Is that going to be contract? Is that going to be part of the university? If, you know, we're going to... add to staff. It's terrible we're having to spend that much money, but I understand that. That's a big, I forgot the number, what was it? That's a big investment. And how are we doing that? Are we doing it contract, in-house? I know that, again, early in my career, we talked about University of Oregon was the first to have its own campus police force. And so what's the, how's that being run out?
Coach Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett. The security investment that I just mentioned, the $15 million, is actually a capital investment. It's not an investment in security, like in terms of security personnel. So I don't have a full list of all the investments. I believe that it was supposed to be left to institutions for them to decide the best investments to make for their own security. But I would imagine it would be things like locks for doors and things of that nature.
Coach Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, that's correct. And if we have time either today or in a subsequent presentation, we'll talk about our capital projects, including the ones that Patrick has mentioned, including the $15 million campus safety investment, and can give you a little bit more information about what was expected through that investment.
So there are a few other changes that are sort of the type of routine changes that we in DAS make that might not rise to the level of Director Cannon's presentation. We did also, we updated the DAS price list and state government service charges for HEC that HEC pays to DAS and other agencies based on a reduction in DAS's costs. DAS took a reduction the same as all other departments did, and that reduced the HEC costs. And then finally, we shifted some debt service for Build America bonds from other funds to federal funds. And that concludes my presentation. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you. Okay. With that, I'm going to close this one. Right. Okay. Thank you, Patrick. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5524. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5525, which is the Higher Education Coordinating Commission fee bill, which Executive Director Cannon, I believe.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of invite Juan Baez-Arevalo to present testimony to you on House Bill 5525.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez-Arevalo, Director of Private Postsecondary Education for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. House Bill 5525 will ratify a new program application fee of $1,000 for each new program proposed to be offered by a private career school. Senate Bill 218 of the 2015 legislative session authorized the HEC to establish such a new program fee. For over a year prior to the introduction of that legislation, our PCS, Private Career Schools Advisory Council, had various discussions in 2014-2015 about establishing such a fee to cover the staff-intensive costs of administering and reviewing new applications. As you know, the Private Career Schools Unit is a self-funded unit of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The review of new programs is quite extensive and requires a good deal of staff time. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission held hearings in August of 2015, and in September of that same year, the HEC adopted the proposed permanent amendment to Chapter 715, the Private Career Schools Unit, and then we requested DAS approval to move forward with that new program application fee.
And can I ask, was there a fee? Was there no fee before, or was it lower?
There was no fee before.
Okay.
So Senate Bill 218 in the 2015 session authorized us to establish the fee.
Okay, Senator Thompson.
I was looking in the bill. I couldn't find how many of these applications do you get a year? What are you going to generate? What kind of dollars are you looking at getting this? What do you need?
Certainly.
Costs?
Senator Thompson, Madam Co-Chair, we expect to get about 32 or so applications in any given biennium. As the industry, the sector of private career schools transforms, they're going to be transforming their programs and adding new programs. Interestingly, we were so proactive in having conversations with the schools about establishing the fee you know, and then having the legislature authorize the fee, and then we went through the process of getting the fees into rule. We had a surge right before the fee went into effect. If you think about private sector, good business thinking people, they jumped ahead of time, and then subsequently we had some additional ones.
Follow up.
So do you do program reviews for public institutions too, or just private?
Our office only conducts reviews of private institutions, the regulated institutions, which are primarily, in this case, private career schools, which are the non-degree granting certificate-only career schools that we have throughout the state.
Director Cannon, can you speak?
Yeah, Senator Thompson, members, Madam Co-Chair, for the public community colleges and public universities, commission approval is required to start a new academic program. It involves, on the whole, a lesser degree of review than we do on the regulated side, where the fee is involved and approval is also required before they move forward. But in certain circumstances, for example, I alluded to the PSU, University of Oregon, graduate case in Portland, there was significant commission attention to the proposal by University of Oregon, given the responsibility the commission has for coordination of public higher education.
And is there a role that the community colleges, for example, and the university's boards may play in that in degree development as well?
Representative Smith-Warner, members of the committee, yes, very much so. No new academic program at a community college or university comes to the HEC before having been, at least ordinarily, before having been approved by a university or community college board. That itself is typically the conclusion of an institutional process that may take many years, begins at a faculty level, goes through various kind of reviews at a faculty and institutional level before coming to their board and finally to the HEC.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's also a responsibility between the two groups. If a private company is already offering a program, the community college has to take that into consideration, and I don't know how that works, but I know that there's a number of rules and regulations we've put in place.
Senator Roblin, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I'll get corrected if I misspeak in this at all, but it used to be the case that under state law, there was something called an adverse impact statute, which was designed to ensure that a new public program did not have an adverse impact on any existing private degree program that was, or certificate program that was in a similar field. That law was repealed by the legislature, I believe, in 2013. And so as a result, we no longer have that adverse impact process or notification requirement for the private institutions.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions, colleagues? Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah, that was the primary reason that most of our community colleges, all but two, I think, didn't have a truck driving school program, and we're short on truck drivers across the state, and the trucking companies tell me that many of their truck drivers are retirement age or older, and we really need to have to be developing more, training more truck drivers, and yet they had that law before 2013 that said if you got a private truck driving school in your vicinity, then you can't have one at the community college. If that's no longer the case, then we need to be talking about instituting more truck driving schools as part of our community college programs, because there's a shortage, and it's good paying, they're good paying jobs, and we need to be training a new generation of truck drivers to replace all the old guys that are wanting to retire.
Thank you.
Guys and gals, I should say, not all truck drivers are men anymore.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. Anything else?
Nope.
Okay, thank you so much. With that, we're gonna close the hearing on Senate Bill 5525.
And Director Cannon, if you would like, we do have a hard stop today at 9:45. If you would like to either do a quick overview of the capital construction items that were mentioned in Patrick's presentation, if with the committee's understanding that our time for questions will be limited and that we had originally planned to have this at a later date, so this can kind of give us a heads up, but you will have future opportunity to kind of check in. But I thought we thought it might be helpful since we have the time to get a glimpse of it.
If you think 15 minutes, we'll spend 10 minutes on capital, see where we get. So Patrick Crane, and in fact, I will just take a seat, and these guys can run through it.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and reopen Senate Bill 5524 then, and then if you'll both introduce yourselves for the record when you begin your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Andrew Rogers, Director, University Budget and Finance at the HEC. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip through a handful of slides here, and we'll jump right into talking about the process that the HEC used in prioritizing capital project proposals for the public universities. This slide here has an overview of the current inventory of education and general square footage on each campus. E&G square footage, as we call it, is the space dedicated to delivering instruction and associated services. This slide presents that same data in a different way and also shows the breakout of square footage between the three large institutions, Portland State University, Oregon State University, and University of Oregon, versus the regional and technical institutions. Here we see an overview of the process that the HEC Commission used in prioritizing university capital proposals. That's a statutory responsibility of the HEC. And the process we used this year was very similar to last biennium. It began with the Commission considering a capital policy statement, which staff then translated into a scoring rubric for prospective projects. At the same time that work was undertaken, the institutions generated their capital proposals and met and collectively separated those proposals into priority tiers. Once those priority tiers and project details were submitted to the HEC, staff then applied the scoring rubric that the Commission had adopted. That resulted in a staff proposed list, which was reviewed and modified by the HEC Commission and ultimately forwarded to the governor for consideration in her governor's budget. The policy priorities that the HEC included in a scoring rubric for this year are presented on the next few slides, and I'm just going to highlight a few of them. Here you can see that all state-backed debt should support the Commission's strategic plan. You can think of this as prioritizing investment in classroom, laboratory, research, or student services space. You can also see that the capital policy and rubric emphasize projects that generate operational cost savings at the institutions.
Can I ask a quick, if you would go back to that one, the idea, the state-backed debt will serve either two in those three. Can you think of a quick example of something that wouldn't fall under that? Because I find that helpful to, because I'm sure there are lots of projects that are proposed that, and that may, this may be a follow-up question that you could kind of think of and get back to me.
But. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I would love to look through the proposals submitted by the institutions and see if there's one that fits.
I don't want to embarrass anybody, but it's just interesting to know what would be covered by that and what wouldn't.
Thank you. The remaining four priorities are presented on this slide. Again, I want to highlight a few. We do prioritize projects that involve public, private, or multi-party collaborations. There is at least one example of a project like that in the current capital list. We also prioritize projects that leverage non-state resources, including private funds raised by institutions or matching funds from the institutions themselves. This slide represents the scoring rubric itself. You can see the scoring breakdown. A few items on here that have not been on the last two slides that I just want to highlight is the campus priority. It's worth 20 points. This is an opportunity for each campus that presented multiple projects to rank those projects in terms of its own priority. The next few slides are going to show a list of the projects in the priority order that the HEC created. Before we look at that, it might be helpful to just overview the different bond types that you'll see on those slides. First is Article 11F bonds. These bonds are the debt service on these bonds essentially are paid by the institutions. So there's generally no state general fund backing those bonds. Article 11G bonds, the state is contributing towards the debt service. There is a dollar-for-dollar match requirement on those projects. So if it's a $100 million project, the state would be responsible for $50 million of that funding through debt service. And finally, Article 11Q bonds, these are wholly funded by the state, and there is no institutional match requirement on those bonds. This is the first of two slides that show the projects themselves and the funding breakdown between them. We'll talk a little more about the top project there, capital improvement and repair, in a moment. Capital repair and renewal dollars. These are omnibus dollars that go to the institutions and are deployed as the institution needs to maintain and repair facilities, extend their useful life. And finally, this slide presents the debt service obligation of the state over time. The green is the state share of the obligation. The blue here represents those Article 11F bonds and the debt service that institutions pay towards those bonds.
Representative Wisnett. Oh, sorry. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you show us, is there a limitation? Could you come back and give us another slide showing how close we are to the max limitation? On those, or are you going to talk about that?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I'm not prepared to talk about that this morning, but we will respond to that question.
Mr. Co-chair. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm back on the one previous to this on current improvements, capital improvements. Are any of those for seismic upgrades to prepare for the big one?
Co-chair Smith-Warner, members of the subcommittee, those dollars are deployed as the institution identifies needs, and certainly some of those needs could involve seismic repair. Those individual projects do not come before the HEC for consideration, so we don't maintain a list of the projects that they're working on.
Okay.
Again, this slide shows state-funded debt service over time. This is both general fund and lottery fund. And that concludes the university component of the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have either now or after Patrick completes his presentation.
All right. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Crane. I'm the director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development at the HEC. I will go through briefly the process for community college capital and highlight the list of projects. As Andrew alluded to, the only types of bonds that can be used for community colleges are 11G. We do not have access to the other types of bonds that universities do. Also, lottery funding may be used as well for community college projects. The total request in the governor's request budget for community college capital this biennium is $75.2 million. That does not include the $15 million for safety and security. So in Patrick Heath's presentation earlier, when he arrived at 90.2, that was inclusive of both the community college and the $15 million for safety and security, which is actually for both universities and community colleges, not community colleges exclusively. The capital rules for community colleges are somewhat different than those for the universities. As I mentioned, first, community college capital projects are only funded by 11G bonds or lottery, with the majority of support over the last 10 years coming from 11G bonds. One exception was the 2007-9 biennium, where $43 million in lottery funding was made available to community colleges. But even during that biennium, the total was higher for the 11G. Second, colleges may not have more than one project approved for 11G bond funding that they're awaiting match funds for. And third, the maximum amount of 11G bonds available per project for community colleges is $8 million. Walking quickly through the process that is used, here you have the schedule of events. In February, due diligence templates are sent out to the colleges, and these templates have 8 overarching categories and 39 separate questions that the community colleges respond to when describing their projects. They're completed for both Tier 1 and Tier 2 projects, as determined by the college, and then sent to CCWD staff. There was a capital construction work group that was made up of myself and 4 community college presidents. We did a blind review of the projects. So HEC staff went through and tried to eliminate information that would identify which community college the project was specific to, so that we could evaluate them based on their merits as determined in a ranking sheet and the due diligence process. That group then went through an 18-point scoring rubric and ranked the projects accordingly. This process and ranking were presented to HEC's Funding and Achievement Subcommittee and to the Oregon President's Council. Oregon President's Council made their final recommendations to HEC staff. HEC staff in turn made final recommendations to the HEC, and the projects were accepted with their proposed ranking. The project for Umpqua Community College was moved to the top of the list at the request of the Oregon President's Council to assist them with their recovery efforts.
So you guys are done, the community colleges list is done 6 months before the university's list? According to that calendar?
That's correct. We were, Madam Co-Chair, we were complete in March with the first stage of the ranking process, and then they were accepted by the HEC in May. Here before you, you have the 11 projects that are the Tier 1 projects in the Governor's Request project in rank order. Again, as I mentioned, UCC's project, Umpqua Community Colleges, was moved to the top. Otherwise, these are in the order that they were ranked by the Community College Capital Work Group. In your final slide on this topic, we just have a chart showing the community college general funded debt service from 2005 up through 17-19. And that concludes community college capital. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them, or we can turn it over to Executive Director Cannon.
I'm happy to give Mr. Cannon the last 35 seconds or so.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know you're out of time. The final slides here reflect our description of the $15 million capital investment in campus safety at public colleges and universities. That was the result of a recommendation that came from a governor-convened campus safety council that worked over the course of more than a year. That's a one component of a much larger report that contains a number of other recommendations, but it does reflect that committee's intent that the state make $15 million available to institutions for capital investments in campus safety, including locks, lighting, other physical capitalizable investments to improve the safety and security of our public colleges and universities. This slide really reflects the larger set of recommendations that that committee came up with. They included a council, efforts around training for response, continuing recovery, law enforcement. The red box over on the right is the one component of this much larger report that's reflected in the $15 million investment. It would be a physical security grant program to assist the public institutions. It would be a fund administered by the HEC. Again, it would be those dollars would all be made available to the colleges and universities. There's no formula proposed for how to do that. We would have to determine the criteria upon which those grants would be made for capital investments at the colleges and universities.
Thank you.
I have one
any last questions, colleagues?
I'll do it
okay, great. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. With that, I'll close Senate Bill 5524, and we will adjourn for the day, and we will see you next Tuesday. Is that correct?
That would be the soonest that the committee meets.
Okay, and just to be clear, we will have no meeting tomorrow and no meeting on Monday. So enjoy your four-day weekend, and we will see you on Tuesday.